Can we get her out of the room? Please. I mean, come on.
No. Make her stay and watch. I want that treacherous bitch to see what she's done to me.
This is the Extra Hot Gray Podcast, episode 371 for the week of September 6, 2021. I am Tasty Lean Cuisine Offerings, David T. Cole, and I'm here with Predatory Diet Coke, Sarah D. Bunting.
Don't get fizz on your dress.
Big Creep, Tara Ariano.
Depends on what your definition of is.
And Independent Consul, Dan Rogie.
Twinkle, twinkle, Kenneth Star.
Welcome to Extra Hot, great for another week. Joining us, he is a TV executive. He also co-wrote Monica the Musical, which is exactly what you think it is. It's our friend Dan Rogie. Dan!
Dan!
Yay!
Hey, everyone.
Welcome back. We are talking about Impeachment, American Crime Story. I'm going to keep the plot description brief because if you're listening to this, there's a pretty good chance that you lived through these events when they were reported in the news. During his presidency, Bill Clinton, played here by Clive Owen, we'll come back to that, has an illicit affair, or is it textbook sexual harassment, with Monica Lewinsky, Beanie Feldstein, starting when she was a White House intern. Nothing would have probably ever come of this, however, if not for a sexual harassment suit brought against Clinton by Paula Jones, Anna Lee Ashford, revolving around events that allegedly occurred when he was governor of Arkansas, and B, Linda Tripp, Sarah Paulson in a fat suit, we'll come back to that too, a co-worker of Monica's in the later mid-1990s who tape-recorded her conversations with Monica in the hopes of turning them into a scandalous book. This is the latest installment, as we said, of Ryan Murphy and Brad Falchuk's American Crime Story, but the head writer here is Sarah Burgess, whose next project is a series adaptation of Jonathan Franzen's Purity. Only the premiere is aired as you hear this. Some of us had access to later screeners, but in terms of spoiling the plot, like, it's well-reported American history, so relax. let's start with Dan. This has been a story that inspired you creatively for a long time. Please tell our listeners how.
Yes. I was graduating from college in the very late 90s, and myself and my two collaborators, my best friend Tracy and my brother Adam, wrote a fully produced musical based on the Clinton scandal called Monica Lewinsky. Thank you to the three EHG hosts for coming to so many of the performances. My mom says hi, and she misses you guys a lot.
It really was our pleasure.
Thanks. And listen, like, as little historical accuracy as we shot for, what actually happened is that we kind of did the same pool of research that they did, so mm-hmm. the truth kind of creeps in equally to both of them. So there are actually things that appear in both of the shows, which I found very funny.
Now that we've established that, Chen check-in. Dan, start us off. Should our listeners watch this show?
Well, to that, I would like to register my Chen check-in in the form of a clip. Dave, should I watch Impeachment?
Yes! Oh, no!
Sarah, you reviewed this, and we will link to it, but briefly, Chen check-in. Yes or no, should our listeners watch this?
Yes, they should.
Dave?
Yeah, I go with you.
I'm going to say no unless you're like a real big political junkie or super true crime fan who's just going to ride or die for this franchise, because I found it really, really slow. Sarah, you reviewed this for Primetime, as we said. One thing we definitely agree on is the portrayal of Paula Jones, who's gets a lot of airtime in the pilot, that it's sort of sympathetic and also sort of played for laughs. Talk about that.
Well, Anna Lee Ashford, who was in, I think she was in series two briefly. I always like her. It's fun to watch her working on this. And as usual with American Crime Story, like, I think the sort of gift of the series generally is that it picks these 90s cases, but now that we have enough distance from them, it lets itself focus on things that we might not have focused on and sort of guides us toward what the real story was of these stories. And I don't think that this season is as good as the others, but it's still good at that part of it. Unfortunately, I think that there are, first of all, enough problematic elements that the show itself doesn't seem to know where it comes out on. And also, it's based on another Jeffrey Toobin book. Like, since you guys were delayed, how about using another source than fucking Zoom dick guy? just my opinion. But there's also this very, and I don't know if this comes from Toobin or from one of the co-producers, Monica Lewinsky, which I think was a good choice on the production's part. But like, there is a lot of just like Arkansas shaming, like Arkansas-ism, which like, okay, like it's, you know, at our particular political moment, it's pretty easy to use that as target practice. But specific to Annalee Ashford, getting back to your actual question, I think the portrayal of Paula Jones can't decide whether she's a sympathetic figure or a, just this tacky piece of shit that's easy to make fun of. And that is a problem. And the portrayal of Linda Tripp is a similar problem. I'm interested to hear what you guys thought of that, because I think it's well done, like fat suit aside. Like, there is an inhabiting of the character and the way she walks that I think is good at, like, reminiscent, accurate. But the show both hates her and is making her a POV character. So this generally, I would say, based on what I've seen of the season so far, there are like ambiguities that are not purposeful ambiguities. It's just the show kind of trying to split the difference on stuff. And that is not entirely working for me. Dan, did you agree with the Linda Tripp POV problem?
Yeah, totally agree with all of that. And of the Americans crime trio, I also think that this is kind of the weakest of the three just by that comparison. And it's funny, the response so far has kind of been all over the place in that way. It's like it runs the gamut from like, this is a 21st century reframing of all that is feminism to this is Janet Reno dance party level. And I think I fall somewhere right in the middle of that, in as much as like, it's not unpleasant to watch, but it has this very nonlinear format. And for that, it is so literal and straightforward and plotting to the point where it's almost square. Like, the story jumps around in time to tell the lead up to the impeachment, but it still goes in order to this agonizing detail. I completely agree with the framing of like using Monica as a producer and even putting her out there, perhaps to even obfuscate the Toobin part of the story, which is possible. But it's like that tremendous fealty to that story leaves, it's just like sometimes then it is just that scene of her sitting on the floor crying in the bathroom and not actually that much impeachment. It just gives the first episode a bit of a slow burn.
Well, and she is a huge star. She's going to be a huge star. Her performance is fantastic.
It is.
But it's like, I don't know. I just feel like the show is a little more tentative and not afraid, but just more tentative than it was before. Like, I'm thinking of the first season and that elevator scene, which everyone remembers, between Paulson and Sterling K. And it's like, okay, is that canon? No. But like, they felt absolutely confident that this was a thing that was happening between these two people. And like, that confidence is not here in this one, in my opinion.
Yeah, the fact that Lewinsky is a producer obviously skews, you know, whose perspective we're seeing a lot more. And there definitely seems to be, and not to say that I would do anything differently if I were in her position, but there does seem to be a lot of like, and the thing that you have to get right is this, how Linda manipulated me, how we were real friends at one time, like how it is to be in a relationship with a complete narcissist. Like, there's an episode later in the season where it's basically just, you know, if you know anything about the story, it's like when the investigators for Star's office have basically trapped her in a hotel room. It's like false imprisonment, essentially, because they're not saying that she can't leave. But they're also not saying she can leave. She keeps asking for her lawyer, and they're like, we can get your lawyer, but blah, 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 all the shit we always see on cop shows.
Yeah.
Where it's sort of like, you know, I'm sure this was a obviously a horrible traumatic event for her, but it's like, does it need to be an entire episode of like, know your rights, everyone? Like, right. This is what I mean when I say the pacing is a problem. Like, it's slow. And I don't think that anyone is going to be watching this that wasn't at least, let's say, college aged at the time that this shit was happening. Like, you don't need to give us this much backstory. Zoomers aren't watching this. They're watching TikTok.
That's exactly. And I was like, I know that this is supposed to be considered like capital T, capital P, the past at this point. But like, we are flatly not dissecting the peccadilloes of the Eisenhower administration. Right. So it's like, I can't tell if it's because
more is the pity.
No, right. 23 skidoo. I can't tell if it's because like I suffer from I personally know too much syndrome, or if it's like really the show breaking the almost famous rule that like Cameron Crowe of knowing how much in the past it's taking place. Like, literally lines like, what is that you say, muckraking lawyer George Conway? That will that will never wash in court, star team lawyer Brett Kavanaugh.
Yeah. Like that, then that line they gave him that's like, well, you know, I don't like to take no for an answer. Like, oh, guys. Like, I think I mentioned this in my review that it's like, okay, fair. Like, I absolutely would not have been able to resist that, like, over-the-shoulder retro snark either. But, like, once someone has yelled at him by name, and then this sort of, we're in love with this portrayal of Ann Coulter, like, even though she's disgusting and we understand how this works, we understand how this sausage is made, like, both her and Drudge, it's like they can't decide whether to shit on the actual person or let the actor work. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, like, I just don't need to see even fictional Ann Coulter for more than 20 seconds. Cut, please.
Yep. And like, at this point, you either know who all of the major players in it are and you're watching, or you don't. And you're not.
Right.
See, I was sort of like aware of the larger beats of the story, but not like Dan Rogge involved and like the nitty gritty of it all. So for me, when I say like, sure, watch it, I don't think it's required viewing, but it's one of those shows if you want to wash the dishes, sort of look at your phone while you're doing it, because there's too much going on in the show. There's not too much going on in the show. There's too much in the show that doesn't need to be in the show. Mm-hmm. Like, it is too long. Like, this feels like it should have been a 4-hour event, you know, just two and two and you're done.
Yeah.
And there's too much padding for something all sort of know about. Right. Even me, who's like, I don't know who that is. I don't know who this player is. Like, all right, can we just get to the milestones of this case, because we know what's coming, right? Like, it's like, you know, episode 4, it's almost the dress. Oh, okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And by the way, she's when she's like, oh, I just haven't gotten it dry cleaned yet. Nothing anyone has ever bought at the Gap has ever needed to be dry cleaned. I'm sorry. Like, throw it in the washing machine, it's fine. Let's talk about the casting, because that was like, you know, the slow drip of news about it. Because as Sarah said, it was definitely postponed, the filming of it, because of COVID. Let's go through. We've already talked about Beanie Feldstein as Monica. And I feel like, yes.
I was taken aback that it was the vampire student from What We Do in the Shadows.
It is.
Which then led me to, why isn't Matt Berry playing Bill Clinton?
Oh my God. I would absolutely co-sign. Yes.
They could all be in it. I see a Hillary in there too.
Sure. Yep.
Yeah. But the one of the big sub stories is, of course, Sarah Paulson is Linda. And, you know, she gained 30 pounds for the role. She also wore padding on top of that and has already talked about it in interviews, not going so far as to say she regrets doing the role, of course, but, you know, doing a lot of I'm listening and learning about being a smaller figured person, et cetera. And I personally feel like there are so few opportunities on screen for larger people of all genders, that when one comes up, a fuller figured actor should get it. Like, I feel like this series wouldn't have happened until there was a young actor who was both, you know, physically a similar enough match and famous enough to anchor it as Monica in Beanie Feldstein. So what do we think of Sarah Paulson doing this part? Dan?
First of all, I will say that also similarly, the work we did on the show falls under the rubric of what I would call 90s woke. Like, sure. Our goal from a Monica perspective, framing it through there, was also to sort of like center her story, rescue her image. She was definitely that same, you know, naive ingenue. She had the core of sympathy. It was framed through her POV, etc. I mean, again, at the same time, one of the first things we heard her sing were the words, "I don't know where I'm going, not a clue what I'm doing, like a cow grazing, aimlessly mooing, shooting more air balls than Patrick Ewing." So 90s woke. Like I said, but the way that, we literally, Linda's character was Ken Starr putting on a dress, trying to fool Monica into confessing. I feel like that was the state that she was put in. And here, I think it's almost cliche to rhapsodize about the quality of acting from Sarah Paulson in a Ryan Murphy show. Right. Let's not be boring. But she had to infuse her with such a core of sympathy to make her someone Monica would want to confide in. And she hits those relatable beats, like, you have to admit it. Like, it happens in the first episode and the little time that they spend together, which I assume continues considerably from what I hear through those first 7 episodes.
Yeah.
I think the story is much more in the fact that it was like the character believed that history would judge her in a very different way than she did. She thought that she was going to come out of this at least looking like a hero to some.
Yes.
And that is a tragedy of her character that is far more interesting to track than is she good or is she bad in the moment.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, Paulson, I think just by knowing that Paulson is under there, because you also have another like meta level to this, which is like there's people who are interested in the story. There's people who are interested in the franchise. And, you know, then there's that combination of people that's like, how is this going to be executed?
Right.
Like someone who thinks about docudrama, true crime stories all the time. Like I think that knowing Sarah Paulson is in there is what makes the character bearable, at least in the early going, that it's sort of like, you're also, like, in addition to watching the choices that she's making, you're able to do that because it's her and not actual Linda Tripp, who just became this thing that we flinched away from. And that's another part of it. Like, there was no escaping the story for like a year and a half. Like, past guest of the show, John Ramos, and a few of our friends and I did a dramatic reading of the Star Report, which had just come out, on the train to New Haven. Like, this is how we lived. Unfortunately. Yeah. I apologize to car 3248. Yeah, it was not our best work. We'd been drinking all day. So, I think there is a meta level to it that's like there are the characters and then there's like, this investigator that Colin Hanks is playing. Like, if that's not sort of like Colin Hanks, how much do we feel for this guy or care whether he can do his job or whether he can relate to Monica? Like, I don't know. That's sort of interesting to me. There's also an aspect of it, in my opinion, where certain characters have just so much shit on their faces that it's like you could have gotten any, like, put a, you know, big nose on a broom and use actual recordings of Bill Clinton, because I think that gets closer to it than Clive Owen does. Bless his heart.
I thought he was pretty good.
Okay.
I didn't think he was that bad. I will note, Dave was like, at the end when you first see him, he's like, that was Clive Owen. We saw his name in the credits. Like, Dave does not keep up with the casting.
I didn't think he was bad. I just don't see, I'm just not sure why you're like packing that big a gun into this fight if he's barely recognizable. And also that when the character gets mad, spoiler, then you're seeing some Clive Owen.
Right.
Yes. And that's the essence of his character, though, is mad Bill Clinton. Like, I'm glad he never bothered with a backslap or with a burger. Like, I thought it was what I liked about the specificity of his character is that he gets so enmeshed in it that he's actually so terrified of things coming out that he has to get far more involved in the gossip. Then, I saw one review that was like, he's a super villain. I was like, no, he is a messy bitch who lives for drama. I was like, the second he knew Linda Tripp's name, he just lessened himself in impact as a leader to a truly hilarious extent.
Yeah.
And I thought his performance was fine, especially in comparison to a certain whose wife that you only see briefly in the first episode.
Yeah. I think this is, she's my least successful match to the real person, like, by far. J. Smith Cameron is right here. Edie Falco plays Hillary Clinton. Speaking of people not getting the accent, Edie Falco. Like, no one has been more completely full of, like, the essence of her place of birth than Edie Falco. And, like, she just is not from Illinois. Sorry.
No. I just thought overall the show giving a subject matter and just, like, how the nation was just obsessed with it for so long and so intensely. It has a lot in common with the OJ year in that regard, right? Yeah. It was just sort of like, it was a cultural moment. It was also kind of like entertainment, you know, that I felt like the show should have crackled more than it did. It has a very sort of low energy bleakness to it, even in the parts where you're supposed to believe that these people are like enraptured with somebody else or like terrified. There's this like baseline energy that it rarely kind of goes too astray from in either way.
Yeah.
And it's sort of reinforced with this like very muted, desaturated blue-gray color grading choice that they made, which I thought was like, off.
I liked that, actually. I thought it was shot more like a thriller than it landed, actually. That there was like a Alan J. Pakula homage thing happening that just doesn't quite, because it's like, sorry guys, but it's, you know, the Department of Defense.
Not that I want camp or anything like that, but I wanted more life in this production. For knowing who's involved in all their output, it felt a little holding back their punches at times.
Yeah, I recently just finished listening to all of the still watching episodes about Mrs. America, which was an FX on Hulu series last year that was about like the fight over the ERA and feminism in the 70s and stuff. And one thing that I was reminded of listening to those episodes and also watching this is just like this idea of like, you mentioned Brett Kavanaugh, Sarah, like there have to keep being these like sort of reminders of like, and this is why we got Trump. Like, guys, shit was bad before Trump. Like, Trump happened because shit was bad. We don't need to have this as the lens through which we consider everything that happened in the, you know, 70 years before he became president. Like, there's more to American history than that. And reducing it to just like, and that's how we ended up here is so reductive.
We already have the good fight. Thanks.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
God, totally.
So true.
Yep.
So, yeah. Ann Coulter being like, if this happens, what kind of flabby con men will see a path to the White House? Like, we know. We're all old. We know.
Like, yeah. Right. Also, they're all con men. Come on.
Right. That too. Exactly my point. Anyway. And the other thing about Clive Owen that I think he gets right, and I'm sure this was largely guided by producer Monica Lewinsky, but like, this is what it is like to interact with a narcissist. Like when she's describing, when he looks at you, everyone else in the world falls away. And when you're out of the sun, you're this cold as you have ever been. Like, right. I definitely bought that. That relationship and the Linda-Monica relationship I thought were effectively done.
I just kept thinking about that time that my dad like literally physically ran into William Jefferson Clinton in a golf locker room.
Sure.
And came home like skipping and rolling a hoop. And my mother is like, what in the fuck? And he's like, he, you know, he's so charismatic. Like, if you know my dad, you know how fucking bizarre this is. And also, he still was calling him Slick Willy, but it was like Mr. Slick Willy for a couple days. My mother is describing this absolutely bizarre that my dad was like, you know, I still think he's a piece of shit, but now I get it. Effect that this person has in person. And I think that Clive Owen was effectively, and that sort of shot framing and a lot of blocking and stuff were effectively putting forward that concept that like in the room with Bill Clinton, you can be as skeptical as you want. But if Dave Sr., you know, fiscal conservative, came home and was like doodling, you know, Mrs. Dave Clinton on his PG folder, like he's got something. And I do think Clive Owen does well. It's sort of inhabiting that also. So it's not uninteresting, but it was also maybe inevitable that this franchise would kind of come on a topic that it couldn't quite get as good a handhold on.
Yeah.
Yep.
Maybe they could have had like Clive Owen do all the sexy Clinton ones and like Danley Roebuck play like everyday Clinton for everybody else. It is time to go around the dial. Our first stop is with Tara Ariano. Go, Tara Ariano.
One middle brow and one basically middle brow, but it's in foreign, so that makes it more highbrow. So I'll do the middle brow one first. AP bio.
Is there somewhere we can check the math on this? Is there like a guide to how you determine lowbrow, highbrow?
No.
Or the O just has a tilde over it.
It's just like a foreign multiplier. Is that what we're talking about? Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to talk about that after. First, AP bio, all 8 episodes of which for its 4th season dropped on Peacock last Thursday. And after the move to Peacock, I was extremely dubious that there would be a season 4. But since it now seems like NBC just is not in the sitcom business at all and Peacock is where its comedies live, I get it. Even though I feel like this is a show that only we ever talk about, so we were still lucky to get more of it. But anyway, the show's still very good overall. I am slightly concerned by a slide into Community vibes in terms of how elastic its elastic reality is. I won't get into a ton of plot details. It came out less than a week ago. I don't assume everyone else has already watched it all, but
it's not the elastic reality part of it, because I think a lot of shows do that, like 30 Rock. And certainly the last season of AP Bio was super nuts.
There more, yes.
And I enjoyed that. The problem with this season is they're steering into Community. Each episode is its own gimmick territory.
Right. Hmm. Yes. Yeah. The less the stories are grounded in school stuff, the less it works for me, I would say.
Which is telling me the writers are either out of ideas or bored.
Yes. Right. There's one Helen and Durbin B plot in an otherwise good episode that is completely unbearable. And when you get to it, you'll remember that I said this about it. It involves walking down a flight of stairs in their minds. That's all I'll say. But when it works, it really works. An episode that revolves around Durbin's attempt to cut down on bullying by implementing a uniform policy for students and teachers goes somewhere I would not have guessed. An episode where Jack has to win a bet by proving he has enough guy friends to have a game night resonated with me on a very personal level. There's a discussion about what "you're more than welcome" actually means that felt like it really grew out of someone's lived experience. It's a lot of, that means don't go! Anyway, Bruce Campbell appears in one episode and brings with him a tertiary character that is truly the invention of an utterly demented mind in a way that I loved. Dave also had an observation about this season that once he said it, I could not stop seeing it. Dave, go ahead.
Well, all these kids that are playing the high school students, they're like all in their mid-20s at least, and they're having a lot of trouble this season covering their 5 o'clock shadows.
Yeah. Dave asked how old I thought Nick Payne was. He plays Marcus, the real nerdy kid that sits in the front row. I said 27, but according to the internet, he is turning 31 in December.
And he looks like it. Like he doesn't look like a high school student. He barely looked like a passable in season one.
Yes.
But he's sort of like, I don't know, if you put like a nerdy pair of glasses, right, a more nerdy pair of glasses on like J.J. Abrams or something, like that's kind of... In the ballpark, except over the course of an episode, he's growing a beard.
Yeah, look him up on IMDb, because in his profile photo, it's Nick, P-E-I-N-E is his last name. He has a thick mustache and a pretty full beard, which is funny. But anyway, still a good show. I wish it did more of the grounded episodes. And I also want to briefly mention the other sitcoms we've been watching this week that are also faves. The other two on HBO Max, which has dropped 4 episodes so far. What We Do in the Shadows on FX or Hulu for cord cutters. Great week for comedy. Dan, you were nodding vigorously. I know you watched AP Bio, the 4th season, too. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I just want to... I have not seen season 4 yet, but I just want to pick up what you were putting down on the first 3 seasons, especially the Peacock one. I happen to love it when sitcoms go crazy and go for it as they get into the seasons. Like 3, 4s, and 5s, I love Veep, the crazier it got. AP Bio is such a great example of like an old-school network sitcom that just had time to develop its insane characters. So I want to get 3 TVs. I want to put AP Bio, Mythic Quest, and Hacks, and create an Always Sunny Voltron so that I can just keep expanding that cinematic universe, because I just appreciate all of them so, so much.
Money heist. Well, they're still in the bank. I was very mad when season 4 did not wrap up the second heist plotline the way season 2 did. And it took me so long to realize, oh shit, they're going to leave us on another cliffhanger again. I'm also not thrilled that Netflix is splitting the 5th and final season into 2 5-episode parts like they did with Lupin. Come on. But without getting into too many plot details for people who haven't been able to watch it yet, the first semi-season is pretty good. It takes a little time to get rolling. The premiere has to tie up a lot of stuff from the end of season 4, so it's a bit blah. But after that, the action is suspenseful, both inside and outside the bank. In general, the anti-cop sentiment is even stronger than it was to start, which was quite strong. So impressive. But if you watch this long, you're obviously going to watch to see how it ends. If you haven't watched Money Heist, but you like heist movies, try it. It's good. I know subtitles can be a deal breaker for some people, and I don't judge. I judge a little. But I watched each episode the second time dubbed instead of subtitles for note-taking purposes. It's actually fine. Why did I watch each episode twice and take notes? Because I recapped it for Vulture. And assuming people read those, I will be finishing up with the back half of this season in December. So give them those clicks. That's my plug. You can find it in the show notes. Anyone else?
Yeah, it's interesting that Netflix is splitting these seasons up.
Yeah.
I feel like it's not because of production. I feel like maybe they're feeling that sometimes they're all you can eat all at once formula isn't really working for buzz. Mm. Like, look at all the Disney Plus shows that people are talking about week after week.
Yeah.
You know, like every week got Loki or, you know, whatever is going on in The Mandalorian. And like Netflix is just like, and then like there's like a blip on the social radar and then it just goes away.
They did
like
that with Unsolved Mysteries, though. And then there's like one other property. It's slipping my mind right now, but there's that they're splitting it up. One in the fall and then one in like January. Yeah. That it is crime based. I don't know if that's the logic, but
right.
I genuinely think they're at points regretting always dumping everything at once.
I'm
because
sure.
Now they're seeing how sticky subscriber bases can be when you have a series of shows that you drip rather than just like, here is all 13. You can watch them in the weekend and then like unsubscribe.
Yeah. Well, it's like the same, not just with other streaming services, but like with HBO stuff still. Like no one would have given a shit about The Undoing except it's like, well, I guess I got to watch next week to see what's happening. Like Mare of Easttown was another recent example, which I guess people like that more. I didn't watch it, but yeah, for sure. I think you're right about Netflix. Anyway, my plug, as I said, Money Heist recaps at Vulture.
Dan, what do you got?
Look, I get it, y'all. I have no choice but to watch the same buzzy shows we're all watching at the same time we're watching them. So a quick callback to August, in which aired the season 3 finale of Showtime's Black Monday, which should be on that list. So while you were all obsessing over what happened to the pregnant lady from the Hawaiian resort in episode 1 of White Lotus, the answer is she disappeared from the show's consciousness because once she left the resort, she was no longer relevant to the series' pervasive white gaze. Guys, this is not hard. I was finishing up the Showtime apps with an assist from Tara's login, Black Monday. The first season of the 80s set show counts down to the real-life events of October 19th, 1987, when the stock market experienced its worst crash ever and no one knew why. Well, it turns out it was this cast of Wall Street insiders, grifters, fixers, who collaborated with a mix of greed, stupidity, and coke to tank the market for their own personal ends. Season 2 tracked the fallout from that day, and then Season 3's organizing principle is, I'm going to say, who shot Andrew Rannells, whatever. It has Casey Wilson in it as the heir to a fashion fortune in which she uses her married name, Faff, to rename the company Faff Fashions, which is funny enough on its own for me to watch the entire season. And despite the word black right there in the title, I do not consider this to be a black comedy at all. It is a comedy. It is sometimes just and here is a dispassionate reading of the cast list. Don Cheadle, Regina Hall, Andrew Rannells, Casey Wilson, Yasser Lester, Horatio Sands, and Ken Marino twice. And they have prestiged their way to a princely 2 total Emmy nominations, both for Cheadle, who is great, but where is the justice? Like, did you love Girls 5 Eva's depiction of Rannells in a comedic sham marriage that's more than meets the eye? Well, he already did that, and the wife in question is Casey Wilson. Do you enjoy the flight attendant or the leftovers characters existing in an alternate mind palace where they meet their co-stars free from the temporal shackles of linear storytelling, which allows them to hash out their innermost psychological issues? Well, there's Rannells again, shot in the chest and near death, meeting his old lover and realizing, wait, this realm actually has no real-world ramifications, and he decides to just suck and fuck his way through purgatory instead of learning any lessons. Do you like that sometimes very dumb joke where characters in a period piece know their stories exist in the past, leading to lengthy conversations where someone is like, We just took a picture of ourselves. There should be a name for that. A self-pic? What should we call this? Or even this kind of, we really know it's the past on purpose exchange. Dave, if you will play that one clip.
And by the way, you're a horrible father. You make Bill Cosby look like Cliff Huxtable. We all know he's a rapist.
I do. My cousin did crack.
Are you saying Bill Cosby's a rapist or Cliff Huxtable is a rapist?
Yeah, I guess he does talk about Spanish Fly a lot.
Whoa! Bill Cosby is a rapist? I have to get rid of my entire sweater collection.
So dumb.
Oh,
dumb.
God.
Fake prestige-ass show. My point is Black Monday. I keep chalking up the lack of buzz on my social feeds to the fact that it's showtime, to which I will once again say, guys, just use Tara's login. Yeah. Dig around in your emails from 2017. She hasn't even changed the password.
It's true, I've never changed the password. Maybe I will. No, I won't.
I know. And for my plug, earlier, as you know, we were talking about a very silly musical that I wrote a long time ago, and I want to throw some shine on the actual adult in the room who turned that project into something real, and that person is film and television composer Adam Blau. Woo! As talented a musician as there ever was, who is more lucky to walk around in the world bearing a passing resemblance to me because he is also my actual brother. But even if he weren't, he would still be the person who, after that collab, has continued to write music for film and TV scoring, among others, You're the Worst, Brockmire, Dead to Me, a song we wrote together that was once played on NPR called I Want to Eat My Car, kind of a long story there. And my personal favorite is that he wrote the theme song to Billy on the Street. So what you should do is hire him if you can get him. He's at adamblau.com, adamblau.com. Go get it, world.
Do you know what else he did? He did the sweetening of the Extra Hot Great theme. Took it from a dry sort of monotone thing that I got into what you hear today. So thank you, Adam.
You also hear his voice whenever Sarah wins game time saying, Sarah.
Yes, very rare.
Sarah.
Only Murders in the Building. I do not blame you if you feel like you're at saturation point with this property publicity-wise. I just feel like it is like we're surrounded, and yet it's really good for a handful of reasons. Number one, it is exactly enough Martin Short. This is very difficult to do. Making Martin Short the main dish does not always work out, and this is just the right sort of tapas proportion of him to make it effective. Number two, Murders in the Building is so New York-y in the most loving way. Like, Michael Cyril Creighton, the state bird of New York-y TV properties, is in it. He is a hallmark of these prestige shows that really understand the city but also know how to make it magical, which is reason number three to enjoy the show. It has some magical realism bits and some animated bits, and it mixes things up so it's not completely sour about its Upper West Side residents of the Dakota milieu. It is able to be fond of this type, but in a teasing way that seems to acknowledge that this aspirational Woody Allen film New York is still possible to shoot and production design without the Woody Allen aspect of it all. Like, I don't know who dressed Oliver Putnam's apartment and made a Newark, Newark poster and crammed the place full of mid-century Capodian crapola, which, let's be honest, is for some of us the dream. Emmy for this person right now. So much mouthwatering New York City real estate porn design, which the show basically leans into as a plot point. Don't hate that. And that is the fourth thing. I have not seen the whole season, and I don't usually love a mystery within a show, within a podcast, blah, blah, blah. But this one is done pretty well. It's acted really well by Selena Gomez and not dwelled on for self-indulgent flashback ages by the show, which is a half hour. Thank God. So I'm willing to go with it, not least because I do love a carved out book hiding place in any plot, and that will buy you some time with whatever mystery box thing you're trying to do. All the characters have uncutesy backstory that is parceled out as needed, and it doesn't take itself too seriously. And finally, everything about the podcast within the show, not the leads podcast that they're making about the murder that's happened in their building, but the one they're all obsessed with that brings them all together in the first place, is flawless, starting with the sponsors who range from Rand Corporation, which I like had to pause it and just fall out laughing at how on point that was, to Trader Joe's. Ditto. That the host's name is Cinda Canning. Like, that is the, absolutely the most NPR. Like, do you remember the NPR name generators from like 15 years ago? That probably came from one of those. The show understands these shows and this world. I have not seen the whole season, like I said, and we are also reaching a saturation point on like fictionalized slash satirized true crime meta stories, maybe. But before we do, it is worth checking out Only Murders in the Building. It is quite good. And, you know, Sting lives in this building, plays himself, is kind of a dick. And there's a whole episode about him called The Sting, which, thank you. Like, thank you for stooping to my level with all of this. For my plug, my write-up of ACS for Primetimer was mentioned before, so I'm going to plug a past guest of the show, Andy Dennert, who had this fantastic, super long oral history of Amazing Race Season 1 on Reality Blurred. We will link that in the show notes. That is realityblurred.com, and that's always a reliable source of news and analysis, but this oral history that he pulled together really was like such an amazing flashback to, oh my fucking God, 20 years ago. But it's really amazing. He got excellent participation from everyone involved. No surprise, because he's, you know, a titan in his coverage genre. So check that out. It's Amazing Race Season 1, Were We Ever So Young, on Reality Blurred.
Coming up in the Extra Hot Great Cinematic Universe on the next Extra, Extra Hot Great for all our Patreon supporters, we've got Director TV. That is a new segment from Sarah in which we pick a director and then figure out how they're going to make that move into TV with one of their properties. And then right here on EHG Prime next week, we welcome my cohort from the Great American Pop Culture Quiz Show, Taylor Cole, and we're going to be talking about Why the Last Man.
Today's extra credit topic comes to us from Catherine. It is called Restoring Their Good Name. And Catherine writes, which TV character has an ill-fitting name and what name should that character have instead? For example, I think Colin Robinson is actually too pleasant and melodious a name for Mark Prokes' character on What We Do in the Shadows. As an energy vampire, he should have a name that is both boring and difficult to pronounce, like Doug Schlesinger. Or maybe just Mark Prokes. Wow, shots fired. It is a hard name to say. I'll go first. The name I'm going to change is Brenda Walsh. Brenda Walsh, originally seen on Beverly Hills 90210. That is not the name of a teen bitch queen. That is a 62-year-old school nurse with a big, comforting bosom. Trying to avoid names that were not used on the show for major characters, but that do fit someone who is a little bit dramatic. I looked for alts from among the most popular names around the time of Brenda's birth, which, to be fair, claims Brenda was the 67th most popular girl's name for 1975 and 59th for 1974. Don't buy it. But no. One or the other of those is Brenda's canonical year of birth, since she did her junior year twice, as we know. So my alts are Rebecca Walsh, Catherine Walsh with a K as a nod to our submitter, Catherine with a K, Cynthia Walsh, and Katrina Walsh. That one actually was not on the list, but I think we all agree Katrina is a dangerous name.
Can I just go next, since mine is extremely similar? I don't think, Catherine, this is what you meant, but it actually struck me because you're named Catherine and I'm named Sarah. And let me just interject, we do not consult each other on these answers beforehand. Given the ubiquity of these classic names, it is striking how seldom the Beverly Hills 90210 writers used them, opting instead to christen their one-off character shit like Phyllis and Beverly. These are people who are not old enough to rent a car. No. Like even the Barb graffiti tag. Now we have an explanation for that, thanks to the 90210 MG pod. It was the prop lady, but... you know, for the credits cast kids, Darren Star did okay. The boys in particular, no particular objection, but Brenda, that was not a name anyone in my generation had anymore. This is literally what my notes say. Ditto Donna, honestly. I don't didn't know any Donnas that weren't my mom's age.
That was on the list. I was surprised to see Donna and Dawn, D-A-W-N, but proceed.
Huh. I mean, Dawn, yeah, Dawn.
Yeah.
Donna, Dawn. This happened far more frequently on Seventh Heaven, if I recall correctly, like 16-year-olds named Stan and Edie and shit. And I would believe it if kids on a current show, like, in fact, Only Murders in the Building, having a Mabel, totally buy it because yes. those names come back around. Mm-hmm. Right. But it just felt on 90210 like the number of Carols and Nancys among day players who were allegedly born in the mid-70s was just way out of whack. Like, where are the Lisas? Where are the Jessicas? Where are the Stephanies and the Heathers and the Sarahs and the Katies? Hello? It is entirely possible that I'm the only one who cares about this and thinks it's a tell and a bad one that your writer's room is full of 58-year-old dudes. Like, I'm also kind of obsessed with the American baby boom trendlet of French names, but only for girls, like the cotton candy on the Seine names like Colette and Gigi from right. back in the day. Anyway, it's weird how many of them you see in 80s true crime miniseries about 60s murders. But the point is, a 90s teen should not be named Shirley. I am not a crackpot. Love that we had the same vibe on this.
Shout out to Carol and Nancy, my mother, and Dan's mother, Dan.
and Carol is her sister.
Oh,
true story.
God.
And they were both
and my mom
the 40s,
is Barb.
So. There you
let's
go.
Let's fuck it up.
Let's go.
And Dave's mom is Donna. So we've covered all of them.
Wow. Only one shall leave. So this one was actually a funny one for me because it made me realize like how much of a mark I am for just assuming that every character's name is the one most right for them because it was the one given to them. Like I never watched like old MTV and was like, you know, this duo would work better if they went by Beavis and Christine Daae. Like, really not. I was like, just take some things for granted, y'all. But I was finally forced to reckon with a character name the world has recognized as brilliant in a show that I really love. So I'm sorry to say we're going to need to take a harder look at Jodie Comer's Villanelle from Killing Eve, the most on-the-nose name ever for a bad villain, Lady L.
Oh!
Did I know that name came out of the books? Yes. Does it stop me from wincing a little every time I hear it? No. You cannot just be a female bad guy and be Villanelle any more than you can be Luke Perry at his most rebellious and isolated and be Dillanelle. Or that someone set can't in their you? Ways in the Texas suburbs is Hank Hillanelle. Cast your mind back to our main topic, and no one referred to a gaslighting man abusing presidential power as Villanelle. Cut the BS and refer to her character name by the perfect and accurate representation of the proper British actress who plays her and call her Oksana.
Love it. Dave.
Well, first of all, I'm going to defend the choice of Colin Robinson as a name because this whole thing is he's an energy vampire that steals your energy through frustration, but the frustration is born out of the banality of what he is doing, not of like frustration because you can't say his name. So I think Colin Robinson is, in fact, a better name than any of the alternatives presented. So I'll defend what we do in the shadows on that one. And then my choice is that Snarf from the Thundercats should have had a super common name like Keith. It is time for the Extra Hot Great Canon. Presenting this week is our friend and guest, Dan. Take it away, Dan.
Thanks, Dave. And before I begin, as I told Tara when I first came up with the idea for this canon, I thought that it was simultaneously the most expected and least expected choice I could possibly bring to the table because despite, as referenced earlier, having watched every buzzy pandemic show the moment it dropped, one of my finest viewing finds of the last year was a little-known streaming service called The Discovery of a Plastic Storage Tub Among Our Belongings, containing an old USB hard drive featuring three folders entitled, respectively, The Love Boat, Soap, and News Radio.
Yes!
Yes. So, news radio has played a role in many of our television developments for pretty much my entire adult life, from watching it in its initial run in the 90s, chasing it around NBC's primetime schedule, trying to suss out whether its imprint on TV history would be more akin to Friends or Caroline in the City. Later, it was the daily 12:30 p.m. slot in syndication before Law and Order original flavor started at 1 p.m. in the background while I was recapping the Real World Boston for an old TV website I used to work for. But
wow,
what
thank
I had
you for telling us that.
Oh, sure. You guys should totally check it out if it's still around. I don't know if it is. But what I had never done was watch the whole series in order, one episode per day. So over the course of a few months, we started from the beginning and we did just that. So back in a pre-streaming world, there was sort of this arc. We were talking about this a little earlier, to the evolution of a traditional network sitcom that played out sometimes. It's what I've come to explain as the Seinfeld model, which also premiered with a short episode one mid-season. So it's that like promising, mostly clunky short first season. The characters are learning who they are, seeing what stories and combinations work. It's extremely Seinfeld, and it still happens when those great shows are still allowed to discover themselves a bit as they go. We talked about AP Bio. And usually this first season contains some of the worst episodes as the show finds its footing. See the news radio episode where Bill and Beth go on a date to a work function together and we're meant to believe he was sexually harassing her. Gross. Until we discover that the twist of the episode was that it was actually her sexually harassing him. Mega gross.
Why would she season... send her daddy?
Indeed. Why would... Fine. Pull out the funny line. Season two, things start to find their footing with a smattering of near classic moments. That was Seinfeld's The Pony remark, that in news radio is where Bill acquires a cane. But it's in season three where things really start clicking and the writers know how to best deploy the cast. And in its best moments, it's sort of like where the platonic ideal of the show falls, a true ensemble where everybody gets their moment and you're somehow not distracted by personalities as strong as Andy Dick or Joe Young. Yes, literally that Joe Rogan, Rogan. So when I watched the whole series in order, I actually realized I was just slightly off on the actual creative peak of the show. Like, even before Phil Hartman's untimely and tragic death, the show had become this perpetual motion machine, spinning faster and faster and faster until its slapstick nature, that was Phil Hartman singing patriotic anthems, Phil Hartman as office talent show vocal coach. There was an episode in space, characters just generally smashing through huge office windows, jumping through them with their entire bodies. It's like a bicycle tire spinning and spinning and disconnected to the chains that made them go anywhere. But don't get me wrong, I love when comedies flirt with spinning off their axis like this. Like I said, I liked Veep, the faster and more unhinged it became. So after my 45-minute preface explaining the taxonomy of 90s sitcoms, submitted for your approval, the moment when the ensemble of news radio was working at its ensemble peak, when no cast member had supremacy over another, when the tone and pacing and jokes and relatability and character in equal measure, again, hard to do when you're juggling seven main cast members and two of them are Andy Dick and Joe Rogan. And that moment, to my surprise, was season three, episode 16, Kids. So Kids is a little risky. It is literally about Dave, played by Dave Foley, continually finding graphic pornography all around the office on the same day that an elementary school field trip comes to spend the day at NYX. It feels like it's pushing boundaries for network television, saying what they could and metaphoring sometimes where they couldn't, a kind of tonal air to Seinfeld's The Contest, which, fun fact, was directed by the same person, Tom Jones. It also walks a very fine line on cringe, so for that, it's best to focus on the writing and performance of what people saw in the moment rather than overthink that time a bunch of real elementary school children spent a day on set with Andy Dick and Joe Rogan. So, after a very silly cold open where Dave briefly takes Matthew's role as office pratfall spaz, we get right to the story. Dave enters the break room and spies a nudie magazine, immediately trying to hide it behind his back. Bill has his number right away, both calling out Dave's inability to pull off a wacky caper, as well as making fun of his Canadian heritage in clip one.
Misplay something?
Nope, just looking for some pretzels.
Really? Yeah, I thought maybe you were looking for some erotic literature.
Is that the Canadian phrase for porno mag?
Yes.
Well, thanks for the offer, Chief, but I'd buy my adult magazines at a newsstand 30 blocks from my house while wearing a fake mustache.
Immediately following, the cast helps establish the premise for the episode quickly enough, as the show gives a sense of its joke pacing in the morning staff meeting in clip two.
Sorry to keep everyone. I just had to get something organized.
At any rate, I have become involved with a charitable organization that I think we can all get behind.
Glad to, Jim. How much?
It's not money I'm looking for, Bill. It's time.
Glad to, Jim. How much?
Shut up, Bill.
Glad to, Jim.
I have recently become a mentor to a group of young students who I think could just be the broadcasters of the future.
The broadcasters of the future. Wow.
They're not time travelers, Matthew. They're just bright, motivated kids who could learn a lot from watching all you people work. So what do you say?
That's okay.
I love it. All yeah. Fine by me. Let's give it a shot. How about next week?
How about right now? Come on in, gang!
Sir, I thought they'd be a little older.
Yeah, well, that's what I thought when I met you, Dave.
Hello. Welcome to the magical world of WNYX.
You're stupid.
That one's mine.
That one's mine.
So that kid fell down. So in this 1 minute, the show manages to knock off character-specific jokes about Dave's age, Bill's jerky self-absorption, and when that one kid runs into the frame and immediately spaz falls, Matthew's spazness. As it turns out, Jimmy is not really interested in helping young minds develop professional skills at all. He's just trying to date their teacher, which also plays into a series arc of Jimmy using the station's resources as a means of finding a wife. While he's off romancing her, we dive into the investigation itself as our core cast quickly doubles as each cast member adopts a proxy kid who is most like them. And it is hard to hear it on a podcast, but the nimbleness of the physical humor is also on display in the ensemble scenes that follows, from the grown-ups putting their hands over the kids' ears in unison whenever they say anything adult, to Bill feeding his kid a cookie every time he does Bill's bidding in clip three.
I don't care who's leaving these porn mags around. I just want it to stop.
Quiet! The great Bill McNeil will now speak.
Well put, Kevin. Let's be honest here. Just because someone was careless enough to leave these dirty porn mags around doesn't mean we need a lecture about...
Look, a lecture might save us a lawsuit.
Can I have a soda?
Sure.
Joe, why is that kid duct taped to your back?
Because I needed two hands free to demonstrate the many other uses of duct tape.
For one, it cures COVID. Sorry. Anyway, there is literally an Emmy for Bill's kid in just the way he tilts his head whenever Bill gives him a cookie. But this boys-only meeting is broken up by the far more thoughtful, engaging, investigative women who do not take well to being shut out of said boys' meeting. So the ensemble ships over to the girls' meeting in Dave's office, which Beth orchestrates. This is where, for me, the episode hits its absolute joke density sweet spot, where Candy Alexander's Catherine finds the erotic literature that Dave has been stashing in his desk all day. This scene spans an act break, and it's like 5 minutes long, so I will just encourage you to watch the whole thing, including Lisa's mini-me referring to Dave Foley as, quote, the little boy in the blue suit in a clip I cannot believe I did not include. We will start instead as Lisa, Beth, and Catherine are trying to decide how seven porno magazines ended up in Dave's desk in clip four.
Well, these obviously aren't Dave's.
Look, it's okay, Lisa. I mean, just because Dave has one or two or actually seven of these hidden in his desk doesn't mean that you're not special to him also.
Well, I didn't say that it did.
Well, Catherine's right, because, I mean, we all know that men need to look at these on a regular basis or they can get really sick.
All right, Beth, which one of your former boyfriends told you that?
All of them. Anyway, all I'm saying is that if they want to look at pictures of... Oh. Fine. What word would you like to use?
I don't want to use any word. I think we should just forget about this.
How about... Apples.
Apples?
Alrighty, fine. Apples. Anyway, all I'm saying is, even though Dave has a very nice apple tree at home, sometimes he gets curious about what other apples taste
like. I think that it's time we all went back to work. Why don't we just...
Beth's right. I mean, there's a whole world out there full of red apples and green apples and Macintosh apples and...
Fuji apples?
Very good, Kim. And Fuji apples. I mean, Dave might like a nice exotic Fuji apple every now and then.
Right. And his favorite apple is the apple back home.
Granny Smith apples?
Exactly. Good old, reliable Granny Smith apple back home.
Quick side note, which of your boyfriends told you that? All of them is maybe one of my most quoted lines from anything ever. If you don't know what I'm talking about, that's what I'm talking about. And here, I would also like to take this moment to sing the praises of the show's actual secret weapon in that scene, which is Catherine, Candy Alexander, who never had enough to do and eventually left the show on account of never having enough to do. And the show continually filled in those gaps, replacing her with white men from her departure in season 4 until the end of the show in season 5. John Lovitz, Patrick Warburton, Brad Rowe, John Lovitz again, Patrick Warburton. But the thing is, the second she left the show, it's like something got a little tweaked in the perpetual motion machine and it went kind of crazy. Like, you can see it clearly in the very first episode without her, which is entitled Stupid Holiday Charity Talent Show, which is hilarious, but very unhinged. It's like she was this, like, neutralizing agent on the high-key personalities who surrounded her. And I think that there's an alternate universe version of season 5 where it's Catherine who returns after Bill's death, and that new ensemble finds its footing and the show runs for an additional 15 season, finally getting the recognition it deserves. Love you, John Lovitz. Season 5 is bad. Anyway, the episode's pace quickens further until the kids have run wild and Joe's kid has a garbage can full of beer duct taped to his back. Unfortunately for human evolution, Jimmy pretending he had been rain and spained into being a nice person with good manners on his date with the teacher show that the men on the show have actually learned nothing. The same is true about the bro club in the office who all try to take the fall for Dave against Lisa's accusation as the adults in the room take one final crack in getting to the bottom of office porn gate in clip 5.
Well, now it's just us grown-ups, so let's cut the crap. Who's leaving the porn mags lying around in the break room?
Oh, you know, Dave, if you want to discuss your filthy business with everyone, that's fine. I don't see why I have to be dragged into it.
It's not filthy, Lisa. It's perfectly natural. You see, if a man doesn't look at those, he can get really sick.
Gotta love a callback. And again, that line is also a good reminder that every episode didn't actually need to be a marquee Bill McNeil prenathon to be considered among the best episodes of the series. Lest you think I'm ignoring the Jimmy subplot as less relevant than the others, I just have to point out that it ends with one of the funniest meta jokes possible in 90s TV. Jimmy figuring out that the teacher he thought he had charmed into giving him his phone number turns out to be a fake phone number when he realizes that it begins with 555, like those fake phone numbers they give out on TV. The porn is Beth's. She was using it as reference material to try and write fake penthouse forum type letters in order to make extra money. We basically learned this in the cold open. Dave and Lisa reconcile. The kids leave the office with a final bye spaz, and the sitcom world reverts back to one. In the end, this episode was actually a shock for me to watch again, mostly because no one was doing the most, so everyone was kind of doing the right amount. And I guess we did actually learn one thing, that nice Canadian guy Dave is, at least according to Bill, clip 6.
So the guy has an insatiable appetite for hardcore porn. So what?
Hey. This episode disproves the long-held Hollywood maxim and W.C. Fields adage, never work with kids or animals or Andy Dick. And because this episode walks a tightrope to pull off at least two out of those three, I am nominating Season 3, Episode 16 of News Radio, Kids, for inclusion in the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Dan, thank you so much. Dave and I are noted, very noisy News Radio fans. So let's start with Sarah, and Dave and I will close it out.
I really enjoyed this. This is definitely your point about nobody doing the most is well taken. The scenes at the lunch, on the make lunch, are not great. That actor playing the teacher is not very good. So Stephen Root is having to do a lot. But Warren Buffett's got fingernails like a coal miner is a great line. I'd also like to say that that cold open, like, it is impossible to sort of render this in this famously visual medium of podcasting. But after there's that, like, reversion and Matthew goes, like, spilling over a chair or something, the amount of time that they hold on everyone else in the scene is perfect. It's, like, machine calibrated. And I went back and watched it again and was like, I wonder how many, like, edits that went through. I wonder what they told the actors to do. Like, talk about the machine sort of, like, becoming sentient and knowing what it should be. It's just the right hold on their basically non-reaction to him, like, yard sailing all over the office again. Joe Rogan is barely in this. Thumbs up. The thing where he just, like, the duct tape evolving joke that it's like a sight gag that he barely has to do anything for is perfect. It really is timed to, like, the well put Kevin and the cookie feeding is perfectly timed. The apples thing is one of those sitcoms, like one of those sitcom things that it's like, let's talk about something sexy in front of children that you're like, there's a lot of ways that this could go, not even wrong, just like nowhere I care to follow. And this is really well done. And like the fact that they didn't underline the Granny Smith bit was really good. And it sounds, I mean, it might sound like I sort of admired the construction more than I enjoyed the episode, which is not true. Like, it just sort of, like, rolls along. It's really well paced. And like you said, I think it's completely in balance. And, you know, as any show goes along and ages and, you know, people, like, actors leave and stuff like that, like, things fall out of phase. Washers fall out, like, but right now this is like the show at its most itself, I think. And so many enjoyable lines that I finally stopped writing them down. But yeah, excellent presentation, especially choosing not to focus on, like, they were really trying to make that lunch go. It's like, oh, here's a fart joke. Fuck it. This woman's not funny.
Right.
So way to leave it out. But I don't think the episode needs it to get in the canon. And I think that your rationale explained why perfectly well. So, yeah, great work, Tara and or Dave.
I'll go next. Joe Rogan rarely has much to do. He's usually, considering how many cast evolutions the show went through, it's really surprising that he's stuck around because he's not a good actor.
Yeah. I mean, is that like a mafia, like, no show, no work job? Like, I don't understand.
I feel like his talents are perfectly employed on News Radio. Like, he's your janitorial-esque lunkhead in the sitcom characterization. Yeah. And, like, he just does that, right? He's just like this weird tunnel vision engineer wannabe character. It doesn't really have to emote that much.
It is funny that in later years they gave him, like, conspiracy theorist as a characteristic, much in the same way that I think some writer noticed, wow, Dave Foley is always holding a coffee cup in all of his scenes to give himself something to do with his hands. Let's make coffee addict one of his character notes.
Yep.
Anywho, this is a very good episode. And season three is a very good season. It kicks off with another episode that we already have in the canon, which is Jimmy running for president. And that amazing reveal at the press conference of him and his mustache photo from the 70s or 80s or whatever it was supposed to be. So, yeah, that was it's a very strong season. And you're right about John Lovitz. If he was ever supposed to be a series regular, it should have been playing Llewellyn St. Clair, the theater director from The Simpsons, on something. And you're right, too, that the kids are all good because they are deployed very judiciously. Other than other than Bill's kid, none of them really has any dramatic stuff, you know, resting on their shoulders too much or too cloyingly. And you're certainly right about Catherine and Candy Alexander. And I'm going to think about the alternate universe where it was she in season five rather than John Lovitz a lot. But all of that said, I mean, it's a problem that we often have with shows like this, where it's like the whole season is so good. This episode is also good. I don't know if it like spikes out for me as an extremely special one in the midst of all of that very strong work. So I'm going to ponder that while Dave goes. So, okay. Dave.
All right. Well, I'll be the ogre as usual. I think this episode is perfectly fine and I enjoy it as I enjoy almost all news radio episodes. But I feel like this isn't as funny as a lot of the other ones that have been in the canon. And we have quite a few in the canon already. And I feel like a couple other candidates I might personally put up. I feel like the whole kids mini me thing is actually kind of safe for this show, where like everybody gets their own version of themselves as a grade schooler. A lot of the jokes were just one joke for the whole episode, and that I already had the joke at minute 5 that I had in minute 25. So I actually kind of, for news radio, I kind of think when it's imbalanced is better. When we're actually dealing with one or two of the characters are the strongest episodes of this show. Stargate Defender, Bill as Mark Russell. Like these are, for me, the memorable episodes that have a joke density that is sort of jaw-dropping, like how much they fit in. And I feel like this one, well, is well-crafted and it moves along and there's nothing wrong with it. I just feel like it's like just like one level below. Below the stuff we've been putting in the canon. Like, I can't say anything bad about it, but I don't think this would be in my top 10. Although everything you've said about the show generally, I totally agree with. And I never really considered Catherine coming back as a character in season 5 and like reframing the show that way probably would have been more successful than what they ended up doing. Although there were some okay moments in that season. I feel like if I had an honest reaction from the people that made the show and I said, do you feel like you just should have ended it when Bill, like, you know, he couldn't use Bill anymore? They would be like, yeah. It's like, yeah, you're right. It's not the reality they lived in. All right. So let's put this to the official vote. Sarah D. Bunting.
You're stupid. Just kidding. I'm going to vote yes.
Tara?
Regretfully, I'm going to vote no. Sorry, Dave. Oh. I love you and I loved your presentation, but I feel like there are other episodes, if we have to be selective, that I would put in the canon ahead of this one, including ones that you have submitted your own self. Indeed. So please come back and try again. But yeah, this one isn't in my upper percentile.
Yeah, I'm going to say no as well. And I just a note, language is a moving target and there's a lot of spaz that we don't say anymore. We just don't kind of use that word anymore.
Right, but to Dan's point of earlier of 90s woke, it's like, well, there's another word that they were saying spaz instead of, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that means, unfortunately, News Radio, Season 3, Episode 16, Kids, you hereby not inducted into the Extra Hot Green Candy.
Dan's so mad.
For shame.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time for Winner and Loser of the Week. Tara has this week's winner.
Well, I said that this was a good week for comedy, but it was actually a good week for comedy earlier in August with the premiere of Reservation Dogs on FX on Sci Hulu. And it has been renewed. There will be a second season at FX on Hulu, which is great news. It's a really interesting, strong show. I'm sure we will have canon submissions for it in the not-too-distant future. So if you haven't checked it out yet and you have Hulu, you should. And if you don't have Hulu, I mean, I guess hit me up because I'll give you my password, apparently.
And loser of the week, Sarah?
Law & Order SVU, which is losing two series regulars, Jamie Grayhider and Damore Barnes, in the season 23 premiere, which is coming up in a few weeks. They were just upped to regulars last year, and apparently now Hyder has said that this was not her choice, and she was a little bit salty about it on social media. And I suspect, I don't know what was going on with her character, who I really liked. But I think that they looked at this sort of ongoing storyline last year that was trying to contend in the most like Benson forward way possible with Black Lives Matter and accusations of propaganda. And we're like, well, we're done with that shit. So the characters who were pro that agenda can be jettisoned. But yeah, the show, I don't know. I mean, I'm in, but it's not good.
Speaking about, I don't know. Do you know what time it is? Let's get that. Welcome back, everybody, to Game Time. This is the eighth Game Time of the current season. Our standings are Sarah with 3, Tara also with 3, and Value Guess on the board with 1 victory. Today we are playing That's My Name Too from Mike Seifert, who earns himself an extra credit topic. I will give you 2 actors who played TV characters with the same first name on 2 different shows. You have to give me that shared name and also the character's last name. So here's how the point system is going to work. You're just naming the characters. I'm going to give you 2 points for the common first name and then 2 points for every full name that you can give me. If you need a hint, I will give you the shows involved, after which everything is worth 1 point. You either have to answer everything at the 2-point level or answer everything at the 1-point level. So if you ask a hint, you're now all 1 point. So
got
you
it.
Have
got
to really
it.
Think gotcha. About whether you want that hint or not and do the calculus in your head on the point question ROI. So, for example, if I gave you Steve Carell and Jason Bateman, the common name, first name would be?
Michael.
Correct. And the full names would be?
Michael Scott and Michael Bluth.
Yes, from The Office and Arrested Development.
Right.
Steel meal situation, please, Tara. And don't forget about Eric's meal.
I shall not. Sarah D. Bunting has 2 steel meals. I have 9 steel meals. Valued guest had 2 already, plus the Eric meal. So, Dan, you have 3 steel meals to play with. And you have listeners, so you know how this works.
All right, let's throw it to Piggy to see our order today.
We will start with Sarah.
All right, Sarah, Dan, Tara, is our order today? Are we ready to play That's My Name Too?
Yes.
Yes.
Sarah D. Bunting here. Sarah D. Bunting, here are your actors. We are talking Bob Odenkirk and Dominic West.
Okay, so Bob Odenkirk plays, the first name is Jimmy.
2 points.
Jimmy's McGill from Better Call Saul, and McNutty from The Wire.
Wow.
Yes, McNutty. that is good for the full 6. And don't write us. We know it's McNulty. Dan, Ed O'Neill, Ian McShane.
So, wait, hold on. Okay. So, wait, hold on. Ed O'Neill. Oh, God. Oh, my God.
Talk it out.
Because he played... It's Married with Children, and he is the same... Good God!
You know it.
All right. I do!
Work it the other way.
The name is Al.
Yeah!
And Bundy is 1, and Al... Oh. That I don't know.
Very good, though.
From Deadwood, that is right. Al Swearengen.
Oh, there you go.
Good for 4
Swearengen.
Points. So, Tara.
Yes.
Aaron Paul, John Stamos.
Okay, common name is Jesse. Aaron Paul is Jesse Pinkman from Breaking Bad. And John Stamos is Jesse Katsopoulos. from Full House.
Yes. Oh,
wow.
Nice pull.
I never would have gotten that one.
Back to Sarah D. Bunting. We have My Attorney, a.k.a. Maura Turney, and Yardley Smith.
Okay. Yardley Smith. The shared name is Lisa. Yardley Smith of... of cinema's Legend of Billie Jean plays Lisa Simpson. I always feel the need to get that in there. And then Lisa of News Radio's last name is Dubois.
Incorrect.
Close.
It is Lisa Miller, but you got 4 points, so you
very good.
Chose wisely there. Dan. Justin yes. Theroux, Brian mm-hmm. Baumgartner. So if you want to employ that hint, you need to ask for it before you start giving me answers.
I'm going to take that hint.
All right. We're talking about the shows The Leftovers and The Office.
A show, literally a show, The Leftovers, that I just finished watching in its entirety. And his name...
Imagine Ann Dowd saying it. That might help.
I know. Seriously.
I'm not capable of saying it not that way.
I know.
He is. Oh, my God. Wait. No. Oh, this is so bad. Yeah, I don't know.
Do you know the other part of it?
His what? His last
Brian
name?
Baumgartner?
Mm-mm.
Sarah, what's the common name?
Kelvin.
Yep.
Kevin Garvey and Kevin Malone Kevin from The
Oh, I never would have known his last
the
name.
The Office. Yeah.
Me neither.
Tara.
Yes.
Katie Holmes.
Yep.
Matt LeBlanc.
The common name is Joey. Katie Holmes was little Joey Potter on Dawson's Creek. And Joey is another ethnic name. Joey Tribbiani on Friends.
That pause. All right, here is everybody's last question of the first chunk, which has been categorized as the easy chunk.
Oh.
Oh, fuck.
Cool. Sarah D. Bunting. Trey Parker, Kyle Chandler.
Trey Parker and Kyle Chandler. Okay, I am going to hope that the shared first name is Tim. Mm.
That's what I would have said.
But it isn't.
No.
It's something else.
What is it, Dave?
Trey Parker from South Park. Kyle Chandler from Friday Night Lights.
Right.
We're talking Eric Cartman and Eric Taylor.
Why didn't he say Tim Taylor?
That's what I thought, too.
I was like, Coach is not a name, so Tim?
Damn. Kerry Washington. Oops. Anna Torv.
Anna Torv?
Yeah.
Kerry... Anna Torv. Do you guys
Anna
know
Torv.
Yeah.
She of right, Stay take... Frosty, my screenplay that
oh, yeah.
will never be made.
I'll take the hint.
All right. Your hint is Scandal and Fringe.
Well, that helps. Okay. So the common name is Olivia. And Olivia Pope. And Olivia... Baumgarten.
Well, the answer here says Olivia Bishop, and I don't remember that revelation sure. in the show at all, so I'm not
right.
sure.
I don't either.
Yeah, so I'm going to put an asterisk on that until I can look it up. Tara, last yep. question of our easy chunk. Mm-hmm. Ty Burrell, Matthew yep. Reese.
Oh, it's he's Phil, or Philip is the common name, and Ty Burrell is Phil on Modern Family.
Yeah, that's not the answer we need.
Oh, Dunphy on Modern Family and nice. Jennings on The Americans. For
yes, correct for the full nice. 6 points.
Well done.
That is round one. Tara, let's get the scores right now.
Okay.
Any second now.
Sorry.
Here we go. The scores.
The scores are as follows. Woo! I have 18. Sarah has 10. Dan has 6.
All right. It's going to take a moment to look that up.
I don't remember her name, and I wrote about that show. I did a marathon diary.
Yeah,
Fringe.
Same.
Anna Torv Fringe. Tanatorv and Fridge.
Fridge.
Yeah, it's not. It's Olivia Dunham. Dunham. I thought that was wrong. All right. Hot update. It's Olivia Dunham, not Bishop. I was correct in my whoop, 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 spidey sense was tingling that it wasn't right. I haven't watched Fringe in a donkey's age, but Bishop is everybody else on the show, pretty much. All right, round two is the medium difficulty level, according to Mike. Sarah D. Bunting. Hugh Dancy. Matthew Morrison. So we're looking for the common first name and their last names of each character. Or ask for the hint, and I'll give you some show information, and you can do it all at one point.
I feel like I know the show, so let us blunder ahead at the two-point level by guessing that the common name is Will. Okay, Matthew Morrison, no idea. So let us cast our minds back to Hannibal. Will
she get the answer right?
Will. No, she, Will. Will Shorts. Don't remember. And then Will on Glee, I guess, is Will Warhol. I don't know.
It's Will Glee. That's who the name is.
Will Glee. Will Glee or Won't Glee?
All right, 2 points for Will.
You were Will, close-ish with Shorts.
Will Graham, because he's cracking up.
Right.
Graham's cracker. And Will Schuster?
Yes.
From Glee, the teacher, right?
Never would have gotten that.
Teacher?
Yep.
Yep. Dan, John Lithgow, yep. Lamorne Morris.
This I'll one take, is I'll insane.
Take, do you know it?
Yeah.
I'll take the hint.
Your shows are The Crown and New Girl.
Oh.
That is demented.
It really... And I don't even know the common name. Go ahead. Someone take it.
All right. All right. The answer there. Common name, Tara. This
Winston.
Is not a steam mill, but here we go.
No, Winston.
Winston. Oh, Winston right. Churchill from The Crown and Winston Bishop from Fringe. No, from The New Girl.
From Fringe.
Tara.
Win yeah. Shorts.
Juliana Margulies.
Mm-hmm.
Andrea Martin.
Oh. Okay, I got it. It's Carol. Carol Hathaway from ER. The other one is from Difficult People. I don't remember the last name.
The other one's from Great News. Carol from Great News.
Oh, right.
And it's Wendelson.
Right. But Wendelson.
That's a pretty hard one.
Sure.
Back to Sarah D.
No,
Bunting.
It's a pretty medium one, according to Mike.
Boop, 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 boop. True. All right. Rashida Jones, Allison Brie. This is for Sarah.
Rashida Jones and Allison Brie. Allison Brie. Allison Brie. Allison Brie. Break me off a piece of that hint, Dave.
Parks and Rec and Community.
Oh, Annie. Parks and Rec and
Bear's and trying to
Bear
give you the
Stock.
Answer.
I don't know.
And Barkinson.
Yeah, and Barkinson. And I don't know either of those. Sorry.
We are looking for Ann Perkins from Parks and Rec and Annie Edison from Community.
Edison.
Dan.
Sure. Yep.
Shelley Long. Okay. And Allison Brie again.
Oh, wow. So Shelley Long and Allison Brie. So she, let's see.
Allison Brie.
I'm going to guess that the common name is Diane.
Hey.
Okay. and then, oh my God, what the hell is her last name? Diane Sawyer. Yeah! I don't remember.
I thought you were going to say
it. Hey, can we just take a second, Dan? I feel like your cord is shorting it out here or something.
Sorry. Oh, yeah, okay. There you go. Let me stop moving. Okay, great.
Okay, do you want to take a guess at the other one?
No, I don't remember.
Anybody in the peanut gallery know the answer to this one? Diane Chambers and...
God damn it.
No.
BoJack Horseman.
Oh. Diane Nguyen.
Yes.
Nguyen, yeah.
Tara.
Yeah.
Frances Conroy.
Okay.
Alison Brie.
Oh, God.
I think the only one... Oh, no. We haven't done the other one that I won't say in case it comes up later. Oh, no. Ruth! Ruth is the common name. Ruth Fisher from 6 Feet Under is Frances Conroy. God, what was her name on Glow? Ruth Wilder.
Yes.
Wow.
Whoa. Well,
nice Glow super fan.
Yeah. Gotta do a rewatch. It's been too long.
For sure. Felicia Rashad and
Alison Brie.
Katrina Balfe.
Katrina Balfe?
Yep.
For fuck's sake. Okay.
I'll put it in the chat.
Yeah. The spelling is unique for that. It's not like the hurricane.
Okay. Okay. Felicia Rashad. I guess the common name is Claire. Claire Huxtable.
Gonna have to replace your sweater collection. Yes.
Mm-hmm. On it. And Clairvoyant. Do not know. Don't know the show. Don't know anything.
Tara, do you know this one?
Yeah, that's Claire Fraser from Outlander.
Yeah.
I know. Outlander.
Beauchamp, Randall, Fraser, all accepted for that character.
Yeah.
This is question 17.
Spread Eagle.
It is for Dan. We have Thomas Gibson and Skylar Austin. Now, you could answer, take stabs at some two-pointers, or get the shows in question, after which each part is worth 1 point.
I will take the shows in question.
Good call on this one.
Thanks.
Dharma and Greg... and Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Possibly the best hint you're going to get this game.
The only thing, the most common answer on the board would be Josh. Hey, that's a stab.
Do you want to take a stab at the other ones? You know it's not Josh. There's a lot. There's only a few other names it could be.
Is it Greg?
Well, it is, but now you have to get the full names.
Greg Beaverhausen. And
correct, it was. Oh my goodness. No, it wasn't. We're talking Greg Montgomery from Dharma and Greg, and Greg Serrano from Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. This is for Tara Ariano.
Yes.
Paget Brewster.
Mm-hmm.
Lily Tomlin.
Okay. I'm going to guess Frankie is the common name. That is the end of my knowledge.
Okay. Fair enough. From Community, Frankie Dart.
Okay.
And from Grace and Frankie, Frankie Bergstein.
Okay.
All right. This is question. For Sarah D. Bunting, we've got Carrie Bechet and Catherine Tate. I just want to say, Michael had the sexiest, most color-coordinated Google sheet ever submitted to Game Time, including a category header called Pronunciation for Dave.
Very thoughtful.
Yes, know your audience.
I would like you to pronounce some show names because I need hints.
We have Halt and Catch Fire and Doctor Who.
The common name is TARDIS.
What? How do you get that?
I don't know.
You might get the common name, but...
TARDIS... Mott?
All right,
and TARDIS McGillicuddy.
Oh, so close.
I just don't know.
Is It's TARDIS O'Gillicuddy.
It
was Clark from Halt and Catch Fire and Donna Noble from Doctor Who. I just remember from that terrible Doctor Who episode that we watched.
The library one.
Donna Noble is no longer in the library.
Right.
Donna Noble is no longer. That was me watching that episode. All right. Dan Rogge. Courtney Cox. Courtney Cox. And Amanda Peet.
I'll make sure I got the shows right. Hint.
Cougar Town.
Right.
And Brockmire.
Oh, God, a show I... Sorry, Adam.
That's not real. That's not a real show.
And I don't even remember her name on Cougar Town. It was Anastasia Cougar, I think. And right.
Cougarhausen, but you were close.
Cougarhausen, of course.
Your answers are Jules Cobb from Cougar Town and Jules James from Brockmire.
Sure.
Tara.
Yep.
Henry Winkler.
Yep.
Eugene Merman.
Oh, the common name is Gene. Gene Belcher from Bob's Burgers is Eugene Merman. And the other Gene is from Barry, but I don't remember his last name.
Yeah, you're correct. I believe it Cousineau,
yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right.
All right, still good for four.
Barryhausen?
Here's everybody's last medium difficulty question.
Oh, God. Oh my God.
Sorry, wow. Bunting. This is according to Mike.
We understand. We're not mad at you.
Mike may have a very different experience than you guys when it comes to what shows you watch, what characters you remember.
Sure.
I don't know how it works in the Seifert family.
I understand.
Sorry, Bunting. Hugh Laurie. Ali Wong. Hugh Laurie and Ali Wong.
Ali Wong. Oh, gosh. Well, it's pretty unlikely that that name is... okay, hint, please.
Jeeves and Wooster and Tuca and Bertie.
The common name is Birdie. Here endeth the point getting. Birdie Wooster? Okay, sure. I'll take that one. And then Birdie Tuca.
No, not going to get that one. No. Okay. Not going to give you every piece of the puzzle like that one. Birdie Song Thrush.
Sure.
Song Thrush. Yep. Oh, right. Sure.
Sure.
Okay.
Damn.
Yep.
Haley Atwell, Kathy Najimy.
Oh. All right, I'll take the shows.
Agent Carter, King of the Hill.
I do not know.
Do you know any character names from King of the Hill?
Yes, Hank.
Close. Very close.
I will steel mill this if I get the full three for all three.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Okay, so it's Peggy. Peggy Hill, Peggy Carter.
Correct.
Nice.
Nailed it.
All right, let's wrap up the difficulty medium questions with Tara. Blake Lively.
Yep.
Elizabeth Rome.
Oh, Serena is a common name. Serena Sutherland. And Serena Vanderwoodson.
Yes, 6 points to close
that
out
round two.
That
is because she's a lesbian.
All right, Tara, let's get those scores.
Okay. I have 41. Sarah has 22. Dan has 6.
All right. That means, Dan, you are in the Grossworth Equalizer Challenge Zone.
Good luck, Dan.
Nice.
Well, I guess it's 6 and 12. I mean, that seems kind of fair, given this stuff.
Yeah.
6 questions, so let's just do it that way.
Okay.
You have your choice. We've got the 90s edition Trivial Pursuit box. We've got the Pop Culture 2 collection, which are around published around the same time. And then we have the original super old TV edition from Ye Olde 80s.
Ha! I'm going to take super old TV edition from the 80s.
All right.
You and Grandpa Bunsey. Good luck.
That's right.
To remind you, get 3 answers correct, you get 6 points. And if you sweep the card, we'll double that. Here we go. We'll start you off with classics. Who said, Wall-E, the rules are a lot easier on grown-ups than they are for little boys.
Gomer Pyle.
So close.
Incorrect. We're looking for Beaver. Beaver Cleaver.
So close.
Sitcoms. Nope, not reading that one. I'm going to substitute that. Racist Archie Bunker. Question.
Ew. Okay.
What Mayberry resident's favorite magazine is True Blue Detective?
Gomer Pyle.
Barney Fife.
Yeah.
What 19th century decade was Gunsmoke set in? So the 18 what?
Yes, the 1870s.
Oh. 1880s.
Sure.
Very close.
God damn it.
All right, so you need these last three to get your points.
You can do it.
Who was the first real-life boxer to have a cartoon series named for him?
Floyd Mayweather.
It is Muhammad Ali. And he, like, clocks an alligator in the credits in the alligator.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
All right, so no points on the Grosso's Equalizer Challenge Zone, so let's get right back into it with our super difficult tier.
My Man. God.
According Jesus. To Mike, mercifully only three questions apiece.
Thank God.
To Sarah, Avery Brooks, Michael Emerson.
Avery Brooks and Michael Emerson. Same hint.
Star Trek Deep Space Nine and Lost.
What was that motherfucker's name on Lost?
Polar Bear.
No, the smoke cloud, comma, the.
Kate.
Okay, so it, Lost and what was the other one? I'm sorry. What was the other show? Deep Space Nine?
Yep. Star Trek Deep Space Nine and Lost are your shows. Looking for the common first name to those characters played by Avery and Michael.
Linus?
Well, that's one of the last names, isn't it? She doesn't get that for if she misses the...
No, yeah, I guess technically, I guess, yeah. I was kind of listening for the first name, so, but yeah, sure. There you go. There's your points. 1 point.
I don't know the first name. That was my guess for a first name. So oh. I don't know anything.
That's why I was.
Yeah.
Well, I think you should still give it to her.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's technically correct.
It will not make a difference at this point.
The best kind of correct. We are looking for Benjamin Sisko and Benjamin Linus.
Benjamin.
Benjamin.
Damn.
Oh, God, what?
Adam Scott.
Okay.
Andre Holland.
Seems like it shouldn't be in the hard round. Adam Scott.
Keep in mind, Adam Scott has been on 20% of the TV shows ever.
I know. Yeah.
Him and Kristen Bell.
Yeah. Is it... Okay, wait. Is it Ben? Oh, it's not even the right show.
I wanted that to be right so bad.
All right, so now you have to try to figure it out. Any guesses on the full names of those characters? Any guesses?
Is this all going to be Ben questions this round?
No, it's not Ben.
It's not.
It's not Ben questions.
Anybody? All right, we're looking for the common name of Henry. That's Henry from Party Down, Henry
right.
Pollard,
oh.
And Henry Deaver from Castle Rock. Mm. Is Andre Holland.
That show we all loved.
Oh, God, I forgot that show even existed.
All right, to Tara.
Yep.
Angie Harmon, Eliza Coop.
Okay. I don't know what her name is on Rizzoli and Isles, so I have to just guess Abby. Damn it.
Oh.
Okay, Rizzoli. Do I get anything for that? Okay.
I mean, I guess if we gave Sarah the point, we gotta give you the.
And
points.
I don't know what the other show is for Eliza Coop, so then I'm out.
Okay. Is that 1 point or two?
That's two, because that was. Yeah, that was two. The answers we're looking for were Jane Rizzoli and Jane Kirkovich Williams from Happy Endings.
Okay.
Sure.
All right, Sarah D. Bunting, Suzanne Cryer, Busy Phillips.
Seriously? Suzanne Cryer.
In case you're wondering what the color is for these rows, it's red.
Ah.
Oh.
For Sarah.
Like Rage.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to guess Kim.
Love that guess.
It's not Kim. It's that other thing that she was on that I don't remember. I don't know. Sorry. I don't know which Busy Phillips it is, and I don't know who that other
person
is. The actor.
We're looking for Lori.
Lori
Bream, Silicon Valley, right. And Lori Keller, Cougar Town, making a second appearance.
Right.
Okay, got it. All right.
Dan.
Good for her.
Oh, God.
Here we go. Dan. Dan.
Yeah.
Keiko Agena and Jared Harris.
Oh, well, that, okay. So I shouldn't even need, what's the first one?
Keiko Agena, I think.
Okay.
Or it might be Agena, I'm not sure.
Well, according to the pronunciation for Dave column, it's Agena.
Okay.
So I'm going to go with that one for now. And if it's wrong, we'll have a word with Michael.
Well, I'm going to guess they're both named Lane.
Yes.
Yeah, they are.
So, Lane, what's it? Lane Price?
From Mad Men.
And Lane Beaverhausen for the other one.
We're looking for Lane Kim from Gilmore Girls.
Absolutely.
Tasha.
Very well done. Yes.
Thank
you. Lee Pace.
Yep.
David Alan Grier.
Okay. God, what is his name on Halt and Catch Fire? Oh, but what if it's the Pie Show? Hint.
Pie Show.
That's not going to help if it's the Pie Show because I don't know his name on that either.
Halt and Catch Fire and the Carmichael Show.
Okay, Joe. Joe Computer.
Wait, did he change his name to Joe Computer towards the end of the series?
It's okay, Computer's twin brother.
Joe Carmichael?
Yeah.
Oh,
there you go.
Slipping in a gimme in the hard round.
Oh my God.
Can't trust that mic. Mike. All right, everybody's last question. So
what
quickly.
Was his name in Halt and Catch Fire?
Oh, sorry. Joe McMillan.
McMillan.
Yeah,
right.
Joe McMillan.
Right.
All right, Tara, can we get the scores here before everybody's last question?
Can we not?
Can we not?
Can I give you money to not?
Okay, Dan has 10. Woo. Sarah has 23. And I have more than that, and it doesn't matter.
Yes.
All right, Sarah D. Bunting, here is your last set of actors. Megan Mullally, Rita Moreno. Is it out of contention now?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean,
your shows are Party
for...
Down and One Day at a Time.
I don't remember her name from that show. I don't know. I don't know the answer to this question or any of the others.
We're looking for Lydia Dunfree, Party Down, and Lydia Riera from One Day at a Time.
Sorry, Rita Moreno.
Dan Rogie.
Last one.
This one's worth 1,000 points apiece.
Oh, thank God.
Kristen Bell, Portia de Rossi.
Oh, okay. Well, I know who both of them are.
Here's the thing. I just gave Sarah some additional information for free.
Right.
And I could do the same to you, but your hint is one of the hints gives away the answer. Which, in fact, then, therefore...
First and last.
Gives you the answer. So I might as well just give you the answer. And Veronica Mars. You just got 4 points for me giving you that one clue. So the question is, what is the other one?
Veronica... Beaverhausen. Who is she? What'd she play?
The show is Better Off Ted.
Okay.
Where she plays Veronica Palmer.
Palmer. Okay.
Yes. She.
Well, well done on those 4 points, Dan.
Thank you so much, you guys.
You didn't have to say anything. It was just like this cosmic sort of communication moment. It was great.
I'm glad you stuck around. Everybody loves a redemption story.
Tara Arrieta, let's close it out with Kevin McKidd and Andre Brower.
Well, Kevin McKidd is probably...
And because you're ahead, I'm going to give you false clues. Kevin McKidd from Howdy Doody.
Sure.
And Andre Brower from Brooklyn 10-10.
Okay.
Geez.
So then it's probably his guy from Grey's Anatomy, and I don't know what that guy's name is. On Homicide, he was, let's say, Frank?
The shows are Grey's Anatomy and Men of a Certain Age.
Oh.
Oh, God.
Show of a certain what? I don't remember his name. I got nothing.
The common name is Owen Hunt and Owen Throw.
Right.
Throw.
Okay. Yes, brother Mike.
All right. Let's get the final scores.
No. Okay. No.
Dan finished strong with 14. Sarah finished 14. Stronger than that with 23. And I had 45.
So let me just hang on a sec. So let me just. Who won? Who won? This is going to do the best.
Shut up.
Tara, congratulations. Well, guys, that is it for yet another episode of Extra Hot Great. We put American Crime Story Impeachment on trial before going around the dial with stops at AP Bio, Money Heist, Black Monday, and Only Murders in the Building. We renamed some TV characters for Catherine, and the only thing Dan proved in the canon is that children are not the future. We crowned... I can do that because Dan's a true friend.
That's true.
Winners and, we crowned winners and losers of the week, and Tara was the winner in this week's Game Time from Mike. Next up is Director TV on Extra Extra Hot Great, and the next EHG Prime is Why the Last Man, and that's a letter. It's not like, why? Remember!
Oh, no. We're listening.
I am David T. Cole on behalf of Tara Ariano.
I was the last person to see Vince Foster alive.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Well put, Kevin.
And Dan Rogge.
Special Whitewater Prosecutor.
Thanks for listening, everybody. And we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
Guess what happens in there?
Some other boring stuff.
Right. Yeah. And then I come in the next day and do it all again.